Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, so this was a bit of a tangent for me, all this this stuff, but it was about 15 years ago, and I was looking at the Vedas a bit, and then Soma, and as you probably all know, the Vedas are full of references to Soma, ninth mandala of the Rig Veda, also entirely dedicated to Soma. It's of the three Vedic deities most invoked is Indra, Agni, and Soma. And then I started looking around at the botanical identifications. There have been two extensive surveys of theories on Soma. The first big, really big survey was Wendy Doniger, as part of Gordon Wasson's book, 1970 book, Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality. Very comprehensive survey of the literature up to that point. And then Van Huben, in the Journal of Vedic Studies about 10 years ago, he also published a more updated survey of the literature and the botanical theories. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of theories about what Soma and Homa was. The Brahmins in India, for a long time, they've known that they are drinking or making the juice out of substitutes, and they use two plants primarily in India these days. One is Sarcostema brevistigma, and the other is Peroplica aphylla. These are both vines which are very common in India, various medicinal and other uses, but are completely non-psychoactive. And the Brahmins know that they've been using substitutes for a long time. The Persians, or the more specifically the Parsis, up until not that long ago, they were using the stalks of the ephedra bush, and that is a mild stimulant. Ephedra is a mild stimulant, similar to coffee or adrenaline or something like that. And there are very prominent scholars, probably the most foremost of those is Harry Falk, who has written quite extensively on the use of ephedra. So that was the situation which I came across about 15 years ago. And it struck me then that it was almost certainly an ayahuasca-type experience. And some people aren't familiar. People here will be much more familiar with the Vedic and Zoroastrian material than South Americans. So just a little introduction to that before we proceed. So in the Amazon region of South America and beyond, to many neighbouring countries in the region and Central America, there is a living tradition of ayahuasca. It can certainly be dated back a few hundred years, and some would push the dating of the use of those plants back much, much further, to maybe 2,000 years ago. That's all a bit dubious, but certainly for several hundred years. So ayahuasca, it's used by shamanic groups in Central and South America, and also there are three Brazilian churches that use it as part of their sacrament, and those churches have now spread out across the world. And since the mid-1980s, the Brazilian churches that use ayahuasca in their ceremonies have been in Spain, Germany, France, Holland, and various other places. Some of those organizations have legal status after long court cases in North America. Holland was the first, then North America, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, and now recently Czech Republic and other countries following suit. So ayahuasca, in the traditional cultures of South America, is made from two plants. The essential thing is the DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a powerful psychedelic molecule of which we have traces in our bodies and in our brains in small quantities. It's also in lots and lots of other plants. It's in beer. It's in various all sorts of other plants in small quantities. Now, the DMT is very, very closely regulated by the body's internal mechanisms, so that only trace amounts of it are in our system at any time. If you consume any plant that contains DMT, it's quickly broken down by enzymes in the gut so that nothing happens. So however much DMT you consume orally, nothing will happen because it's just broken down by the enzymes in the stomach. But if you also take a plant containing DMT alongside a plant with a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, that monoamine oxidase inhibitor inhibits the action of the enzymes in the gut, and then your brain is flooded with DMT for 2 or 3 hours until, again, quite quickly the body's mechanisms regulate again, so the DMT is eliminated. So in South America, They use a vine, Banisteriopsis carpi, which is the source of the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which are primarily in the form of harmine, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmine. And they use a relative of the coffee plant, Psychotria viridis, for the DMT. So to get the exact amounts of chemicals from both plants requires a great deal of expertise in the preparation of plants. And the shaman of South America, they train in all this, and they produce either cold pressed or heated brews of this combination of plants for their rituals and for their ceremonies. Now, DMT is now known to be in about 80 different plants, and there are now also approximately 80 plants known to contain monoamine oxidase inhibition properties, and that list grows by the year. So in anywhere in the world, if you look around, you will find plants with either DMT or monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And then if you then if you combine those two plants in sufficient quantities, then you get a powerful psychedelic experience. So the use of these plants, as I say, is very well established in South America, and I thought there was nothing equivalent happening in Asia until I started looking at this whole thing. So if we look at the South American situation, the strong men go off to the jungle, they cut pieces of this vine, the Banisteriopsis carpi vine, ayahuasca meaning vine of the soul or vine of the dead, they cut this vine, they bring it back to the ritual enclosure, they pound it with mallets to extract the juice, then they mix it with the DMT plant, and they also add lots of different plants to the mixture to enhance or boost or moderate the effect of the concoction. So once this is prepared, it's a dark coloured, reddish, brownish, yellowish, very bitter kind of liquid. The drink is drunk every 2 to 3 hours in shots. The use of ayahuasca has undergone a lot of research in the last 20 or 30 years. There's no adverse health effects. In fact, the very opposite. In long-term studies, it seems to improve people's health and well-being in general. It's drunk in public, in rituals in South America, approximately every 2 weeks by the churches that administer it. Of course, the shaman and the priests of those organizations are most experienced, and people are invited to participate in these rituals. It's used for all sorts of purposes in South America, primarily to see. And it's like one of the most common response in questionnaires is, why do you take it to see? It's also used for as a medicine, as a poet, for poetic inspiration. It's used sometimes for warfare. It's sometimes used for clairvoyance, for telepathy, and all sorts of other things. In fact, the telepathic side of things, it was originally Banisteriopsis carpi, the chemical ingredients that were originally called telepathine because of the so-called or supposed telepathic properties of this concoction. So ayahuasca has been well studied. It's, as I say, it's a powerful psychedelic drink, something like a strong hit of LSD. Also, importantly, it's a purgative. It causes most people to vomit, and sometimes excessively. So I started drinking that stuff about 20 years ago. I had a period of drinking it quite regularly, and then it was during that period I realized that almost certainly in the Vedas, this is what they were talking about. So that led me on to the looking at this thing in greater detail, what was actually going on. Now, if we look at the Vedas, there's very little information specifically in the Sanghita part, but if we look in the Brahmanas, we find quite a lot more information about the use of soma or homa. The first point to emphasize, I suppose, is that su or hu, the Avestan root su, it doesn't refer to a plant at all or even a drink. It just means something pressed. And so often people have jumped to the conclusion that, you know, soma refers to a particular plant. It doesn't. It means something that's just pressed. As we will know here, that the roots of this culture, they come from a similar geographical area, what is now modern-day Turkmenistan. I'll talk, if I have time, I'll go on to all that sort of speculation a bit later. But from central Turkmenistan, the cult of the use of soma homa spread from Turkmenistan to what is now Iran, and then going west to Greece, and finally in about 1600 to the Punjab region of India. That's where this the cult of the fire and the soma arrived. The two main ingredients of the soma, of Vedic ritual being the fire and the drinking of the soma. So this hypothesis was that that what was being prepared was a kind of ayahuasca analog. In other words, using plants that have the same effect but using different kinds of plants. So one of the missions was to try and work out which plants were being used, and I've had only a limited amount of success in all that, but some. Now, on the movement of this, just as a tangent, on the movement of this cult from Central Asia to South Asia, to India specifically, or what is now Pakistan, I came across some rather interesting stuff that I think solved quite a few puzzles. In 1615 BC, there was the eruption of the Santorini volcano, 100 kilometres north of Crete. It was the largest volcanic eruption since the last ice age. It was absolutely enormous. Just to summarise some of the effects, the Aborigines heard it in Alice Springs. 7 inches of ash fell in South Africa. The tsunami went twice around the world. The skies went black in China for 7 years with famine and drought. It was enormous. So one of the puzzles with historians of Asia is the movement of people, large-scale migrations of people around 1600 BC in Asia. Well, the volcano explains that. Not many people, if anybody's asked, why did people calling themselves Arya arrive in India? Well, and around 1600 BC, that date is more or less agreed on. Well, the volcano is now, the date of that eruption has been pinpointed almost precisely to 1615 BC. I've been looking at the sort of latest stuff on that. So that's the first interesting point. So this is how the cult moved from Central Asia elsewhere. 1600 BC is also the founding of Eleusis in near Athens, the cult of Eleusis, which was the mystery rites of Eleusis were the basis of all the other mystery rites in the ancient Greco-Roman world. And again, there are several theories about where the cult of Eleusis came from. Some scholars think it's from Crete or Creta. That has been largely overturned. And the current theory is that it came from somewhere in the north. Well, again, this points to somewhere like Turkmenistan. So, the cult of Eleusis, of course, very secret, private thing. Nobody allowed to talk about what happened on the pain of death. Of course, we get clues from the literature, and people describe the extraordinary experiences they had at Eleusis during the course of the ritual. 9-day ritual, 2 days spent actually in the temple of Eleusis, having the initiatory drink, after which time, of course, you could only after participation in the rites were you allowed to vote and become a citizen of Athens. So you had to pass through this ordeal before you became a citizen. So I'm speculating that the this ayahuasca analog hypothesis doesn't just extend to ancient Iranian and ancient Indian practices, but also to the origins of the that's the basis of the mystery cults in the ancient Greco-Roman world. The potion itself, called kukeon, meaning mixed potion, and I looked quite extensively at all the available material on that, and again you get this mixture of plants, it looks like, in this preparation. So the other thing that I think is interesting about the Santorini volcano and its significance is that prior to 1600 BC, there, as is well known, there were very, very sophisticated city-states throughout the Mediterranean region, stretching all the way to India, which collapsed very suddenly. There's a very dubious historian, Gavin Menzies. He's published in all sorts of things, but his last book, The Lost Age of Atlantis, Lost Empire of Atlantis, rather, I think he's right on this point, he's wrong on lots of other points, but that there was a loosely connected the ancient city-states of the late Bronze Age were loosely connected, they knew about each other. Gregory Porcel, he talks about the Central Asian interaction area. Lots of examples of pottery and jewellery found everywhere between Greece and the Indus Valley in various city-states. So there, of course, there's the Mycenaean culture, various city-states in what is now Iraq, in Iran, the Oxus culture in central Turkmenistan, Oxus civilization, and of course the Indus Valley civilization. All of these collapsed simultaneously, and nobody's really thought about why they all collapsed. Why did these extensive Bronze Age civilization places just suddenly collapse around the same time? And for the Indus Valley, various explanations have been given: climate change, drought, famine, disease, all sorts of things. But it was a peaceful collapse, and it ended quite quickly. If we think of these city-states as being loosely connected through trade and administration and everything else, which is what Gavin Menzies proposes, then the eruption of the volcano also explains that. So why the sudden collapse? And so then we have, after that, the large-scale migrations of people, and people bringing the cult of Soma and the fire to India, the two sort of central elements of that religion. Interestingly, I just read a genetic study which this hypothesis absolutely, more or less, more than a hypothesis, you can say it's 100% certain now that the gene pool of central and north India originated in Turkmenistan. It'll be unhappy result for people who believe that Sanskrit originated in India. But anyway, it's from Turkmenistan anyway, so that's another matter. But anyway, this is 100% certain. The genetic stuff is pretty comprehensive. They've looked at all the gene pools of various parts of Asia and the types anyway. So 1600 BC, we have the arrival in the Punjab region of these people with the knowledge of plants, presumably, and the basis of their ritual. So the theory, for 250 years, there have been all sorts of theories proposed about what this concoction was. I've already stated my own beliefs about it, but just to run through some of the proposed hypotheses. The people who support the ephedra thesis, such as Harry Falk, they don't believe that there's anything visionary in the Vedas or in the Avesta. Well, of course, you can't prove anything one way or the other, and even the evidence is very slight. But I think if you look at some of those passages, like the Lava Sukta, for example, in the Rig Veda, there are descriptions of light, of near-death experiences, of going high in the sky, of flying, and so on and so on. The poets are talking about, the rishis, they're talking about their own experience. They're talking in these Atmastutis, they're talking about how they went into the sky and they had these sort of visions. Of course, you can argue for or against that. My own reading of it is that really these do look like visionary experiences. Were they just taking a stimulant of some sort, like ephedra? Would a religion have been built around the use of something like a mild stimulant, such as tea or coffee? I think very improbably. If we consider it as a genuinely psychedelic concoction, then it all starts fitting together like a bit of a jigsaw puzzle. Part of the argument for the ephedra being soma, as for many of the other substances proposed by all sorts of researchers, is that sum or hum or som is one of the words used in Central Asian languages for ephedra. But then, if you look in the Immateria Medica of India, which I did, then you will find between 20 and 30 plants called soma or homa. Or in the Indian Immateria Medica, soma. But, of course, in Iran, there are other plants also called hom. Mm. So, why are all these plants called soma or homa? Why is it there are all these plants called that? Well, it all starts making sense if we think of soma, that thing that's pressed, as not a single plant, but as a combination of plants, as many plants. And so you're probably getting, the thing. This is the parallel with the South American material. This is why I've been talking about that, because we can see the direct parallels with the way they use these plants in South America and the way I'm speculating they use them in ancient India and Iran. So in the text, it looks like it's something visionary. Again, that's argued about. What people haven't noticed is that if you look through the Brahmanas, soma is also a purgative. even Indra himself, he vomits. He who drinks 30 ponds of soma before going to kill the mighty snake, he himself vomits after drinking soma. And there are quite a few references in the book to how soma is a purgative. It causes vomiting. So again, we're looking at something very close to an ayahuasca-type experience there. The theories that have been proposed, when we're going back 250 years, as I say, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of plants or propositions for what it was. There are only three theories that currently have any scholarly backing at all. As I mentioned, there's the ephedra thesis, supported by Harry Falk and various others, who believe it was just not. Harry Falk argues vigorously that material in the Vedas or in the Avesta does not point to a visionary experience, just as something that keeps you awake, jugravi, keeping you awake at night, being able to recite your mantras and so on, is not visionary or shamanic at all. Then the other theory that caused a lot of confusion, I believe, was the publication in 1967 of Gordon Wasson's Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality. And so Gordon Wasson, a banker turned scholar, in 1955 he ended up in Mexico with Maria Sabina. He took psilocybin mushrooms and had a godlike experience. Before that, he'd become interested in mushrooms through his wife, a Russian woman, and they published extensively on mushrooms, ordinary mushrooms, before that. 1955, his experience with psilocybin mushrooms, he had a vision of God, and he thought, oh my goodness, this is amazing. And then it was, in fact, his collaboration with Wendy Doniger in the production of his book. And it was Wendy Doniger who first mentioned fly agaric mushrooms to him, Amanita muscaria. And she remained sceptical of the idea right to the end, that, you know, they weren't using mushrooms. But Gordon Wasson immediately got enthusiastic about fly agaric mushrooms, those red and white spotted things that are used by people, particularly in Siberia. And there the mushrooms are consumed whole. They are used not specifically in a religious context or a shamanic context, they're just used. They are used shamanically, they're also used just for pure recreational purposes. The theory published in that book, Soma, the Divine Mushroom of Immortality, was enormously influential. And there are still people, Rainer Sturmer is one of them in Germany, he still publishes on in German on fly agaric mushrooms, believing that it was the secret of the Soma and so on. And it also led to people finding mushrooms all over the place. Wolberg is another scholar who finds mushrooms throughout the Greek tradition and sees mushroom symbolism everywhere. There's a whole slew of publications by Christian writers. John Allegro was the first, Sacred Mushroom from the Cross. There are still several more publications since then. I just read one recently by two American scholars. Extremely bad book, they'd been touring Europe and finding mushroom symbolism all over the place, you know, in the early Christian world. So this mushroom thing is, you know, it's gone out there, and everybody's finding mushrooms in the ancient world as the basis of religion and so on. And the problem with the fly agaric thesis, there are several big problems with the fly agaric thesis. One of the most critical reviewers of Gordon Wasson's book, John Brough, who was a professor of Sanskrit in Cambridge at the time, and this is in the late 1960s, he pointed out immediately, suggested by his wife, that in fact, if it was mushrooms, why are these sticks pounded? You know, why is this soma pounded? I forgot to add also that in the Vedic ritual context and in the Zoroastrian ritual context, the soma stalks, they're described as stalks, they are purchased from a soma seller. Then the stalks are pounded, in the Vedic context, they are pounded with stones on wooden boards covered with a reddish bull hide. The juice is extracted, mixed with water, then with milk, and then drunk. So excessive pounding of these stalks or plants. In the Zoroastrian world, it's with mortar and pestle, and that goes right the way through Mithraic rites as well. The use of horma by the adherents of the religion of Mithras in the ancient Persian world, also pounded with mortars and pestles. So, mushrooms you don't need to pound, you just consume the mushrooms. More importantly, as other commentators have noticed, there is a vigorous prohibition against mushrooms in the in Dharmashastra, mushrooms are not allowed for amongst garlic. Garlic, onions, and mushrooms are the things not allowed for Brahmins to consume. Mushrooms are taboo. I think more importantly, I've looked a lot at the effects of a lot of these substances in the book. The fly garlic mushrooms on their own, without being treated, are toxic. It's really quite unpleasant. It's destabilizing. It's a kind of drunken psychedelic experience. And it's not very good for concentration at all. It is quite destabilizing. I've only come across one super enthusiastic report of, visionary experience with fly agaric mushrooms. And that described a very profound experience that the author had with fly agaric mushrooms. But that's rare. Most people who try the things do not have a very pleasant experience. Terence McKenna famously wrote about it. He loved psilocybin, of course, but he found fly agaric really very, very toxic. So Gordon Wasson also, despite his enthusiasm in his publications for fly agaric mushrooms, he tried them on numerous occasions in the 1960s, but he either felt ill or fell asleep. He never had anything like a mystical or visionary experience. So even though he's promoting this theory, it didn't work for him. So that was probably the strongest evidence against his own theory, that he tried it many times, but he failed to have a mystical experience himself. The third theory that has some traction still is the theory of Syrian rue, or harmal. In fact, it was William Jones who first pointed out that harmal might be soma. And this is going back to the late 18th century. Now, that theory was revived in 1986 by two very learned scholars, Flattery and Schwartz, who proposed that harmal was the soma. Now, harmal, or Syrian rue, is a plant that grows widely. Wherever it's planted, it grows very freely. Its reddish-brownish angular seeds do contain high quantities of harmine, harmaline, and tetrahydroharmine. In other words, it's a strong monoamine oxidase inhibitor plant. So, Flattery and Schwartz were perhaps half right in their assertion that it was soma. The Syrian rue hypothesis is problematic because, again, Syrian rue or harmal is not psychedelic. It's been described famously as an onirophrenic, a term used to describe it by Claudio Naranjo, who was the 1963. He did very extensive tests on the use of or the effects of harmaline and harmine on various groups of people. He tested it on. It gives access to the subconscious. It puts you in a kind of dreamy state, but at levels where it becomes almost psychedelic, it becomes extremely unpleasant. Very unpleasant symptoms once you get to a sufficiently high threshold dose with that stuff. And there are other people who've tested Syrian rue extensively with similar kinds of reports. So, only three theories about what it was that are currently supported by scholars in various ways. I won't go into all the other theories that have been proposed. It goes on and on, mandrake and ginseng and various kinds of alcohol, rhubarb, it goes on and on and on. Water, a mere concept, and so on. It goes on, what soma was. But it's quite clear from the text that they were actually preparing something. They Brahmins still do. They still collect these vines and they pound these things. They know they're using substitutes. Now, if the thing is not just a stimulant and it's it is a properly psychedelic plant or plant combination, then what on earth could it be? Now, there's another proposition that it was some form of cactus, unfortunately, like peyote or one of those kinds of San Pedro, one of those phenethylamine kind of drugs. Unfortunately, the cactus family is entirely New World in North and South America. And there's none of it anywhere else, apart from traces which birds have. I've got a little some notes on that. There are cacti growing in Sri Lanka, seeds brought by birds and so on, but there are only individual cases of it. Cactus does not grow in the Old World. So it wasn't peyote or any mescaline-containing plant. Then, if it wasn't a mescaline-containing or mescaline-type plant or a phenethylamine, if it was a tryptamine of some sort, what are we left with? Well, if it was a single plant in Asia that had high doses of tryptamines, I'm pretty certain we would have found it by now. There is a possibility that what they were using in the ancient world is over-harvested or died out. That's another possibility. But, again, if we look at the texts, Fritz Dahl was always very puzzled that in the Avesta there are many homers. He said, why are there many homers? Ah, well, also, if you start looking in the Vedas, particularly in the Rig Veda, you have the Soma of the mountains, the Soma of the rivers, the Soma of the valleys, many kinds of Soma. So this looks also very interesting. There's not just one kind of Soma, there's many kinds of Soma growing in different places. If we look at Sushruta, the famous passage that describes rejuvenation treatment with Soma, again, he lists about 20 plants, some very strange plants also called Soma. So, then it looks as though Soma, or the thing pressed, was not just one plant, it was many plants. And if it was many plants, again, this all seems to me to point towards some sort of ayahuasca analog. If we accept the ayahuasca analog hypothesis, a lot of things start fitting into place. Firstly, if it was a psychedelic experience they were enjoying in the ancient world, what would it be that they could consume, consume regularly at least every couple of weeks without any sort of hangover experience, any sort of drug hangover experience that could be repeated again and again and again throughout the lifetime of the ritualist and again through many generations without any adverse deleterious effects? Again, ayahuasca would fit that case. The other thing is that we need a substance that can, or a drug that can both stimulate and keep people awake and be psychedelic, but not of such a kind that would impede the recitation of mantra throughout these long rituals. So I have another chapter in there on the ritual practices of the Santo Daime Church. Well, in Brazil, there are a couple of churches that I mentioned earlier were are now worldwide. Santo Daime is one of them. The other is the União do Vegetal. Both of these churches run rituals throughout the world. And these rituals, the interesting, particularly with the Santo Daime, the structure of the Santo Daime ritual developed from the 1920s onwards, obviously developed in the jungles of South America, nothing to do with the Vedic religion at all, but the structure of their ritual has some remarkable parallels with Vedic ritual. You have the opening and the closing ceremonies, of course. A typical ritual is about 6 to 8 hours long, but sometimes they're for several days. The juice is drunk, or they call it the daime, every 2 hours or so, first by the priest and then by the rest of the congregation. The whole ritual is accompanied by singing, or the recitation of shamadas or hinarios, their mantras, if you like. The mantras, if you look at the kinds of poetry in the mantras, you could almost like a mirror image of Vedic mantra in the sense of praising the deities and so on and so on. And the priests who are familiar with drinking this stuff, they just carry on doing their mantras exactly throughout the entire course of the ritual, drinking this stuff and keeping the ritual going. Some rituals are performed without the use of ayahuasca, just water. Other times, as I say, it could be a 1 day or a 3 day or a longer ritual. So we're looking at a kind of ritual structure, which is very similar to the ritual structure of the Vedas and also of the Avesta. And what I'm suggesting is that these rituals, if we look at the Santo Daime ritual, if we look at that as an event, we can see that the reason they're having a ritual is to drink the ayahuasca. That's why the ritual was developed, for the purposes of providing a ritual space, a kind of safe hologram within which this thing can be performed and within which this drink can be consumed safely. The interesting thing is that if we look at the hymn books of the Santo Daime Church, there are about 1,000 hymns approximately in these hymn books, collected from or channeled by their mestres, a bit like the Vedic mantras are meant to have been channeled by the rishis. If we look at the hymns themselves, only about 5% of the hymns mention what they call daimi, which is the ayahuasca. But you would have no idea from examining the hymn books that, in fact, the purpose of the ritual is for the drinking of this stuff. That's why the ritual is constructed. And I would suggest that that's the origins of Vedic and Zoroastrian ritual. These are rituals developed in order to provide an ritual environment for the drinking of this stuff. That provides these death, rebirth kinds of experiences. That provides the people with poetic inspiration and so on and so on. And as I say, similarly, if you look at the kinds of uses of ayahuasca in South America, again, we can draw direct parallels with the kinds of uses that it was probably used for in ancient India. Now, these days, as I mentioned, the Brahmins know that they're using substitutes. They perform in various places in India, not that many of them these days. Brahmins still perform the Soma rites, which is the Soma rites are the most important of the Vedic rituals. There's you might have seen Vedic Voices, David Knipe's last book on Brahmin ritual in a village in Andhra Pradesh. Again, he describes in some detail the structure and performance of these rituals. Brahmins use the substitute plants. They know they're using substitutes, and they have been for a long time. In the Brahmanas, you get a list of substitute plants that can be used, but I think that probably the best way to look at that is to look at alternatives rather than substitutes. These days, it's genuine substitutes. These plants that they use have no effect at all. But there were two things, this is all a bit speculative when I was getting into all this, but there were two very useful pieces of information that came along during the course of research. The first was a few years ago meeting an Iranian and Persian, a chap from Iran, who's a great scholar of Iran, Persian and Arabic literature. He's also very experienced in ayahuasca, been in South America a lot. And 3 years ago, he was invited by Kalandar Sufis to participate in a ritual in northern Iran, in secret. And it was a full-on ayahuasca experience. He was attended the ritual on condition that he asked no questions. However, he noticed outside the temple that there were large numbers of bushes of Syrian rue, this plant. So that would provide the clue to the monoamine oxidase inhibitor. My hypothesis from another, only a bit of slightly speculative angle on all this, is that the DMT probably came from giant reed, or Arundodonax, which is a plant that also is very, very common. It looks a bit like pampas grass. That's the plant there. This is giant reed, Arundodonax. It's a very common plant. The Indian varieties of this have very high DMT content. And so if that is the plant that they are using these days in Iran, this might also solve a minor puzzle in Avestan studies. There's a plant in the Avesta worshipped alongside Soma or Homa, rather in the Avesta, called Hadanaipata, which in Avestan means something with many seeds. And there are other references to that plant in the Avesta where they describe it as a plant with soft wood that it smells sweet when burnt. That fits Arundodonax. Many seeds, soft wood, smells nice when burnt. Speculation, but as I say, the Indian variety, a lot of varieties have been tested, but the Indian variety has the highest content of DMT of any of those varieties. Syrian rue works absolutely fine as a monoamine oxidase inhibitor. The first time I actually drank ayahuasca, it wasn't proper ayahuasca, it was made from Syrian rue and Mimosa hostilis, DMT from Mimosa hostilis and the monoamine oxidase inhibitor from the Syrian rue. So that might be an explanation of that. The second thing that was most exciting was an article I came across relatively recently, only a couple of years ago, by two Italian scholars I then communicated with. And they'd examined the Bauer manuscript. So the Bauer manuscript is a 6th century Kashmiri text. It's the earliest preserved Indian medical text. And in there are two formulas for Amrit or Soma. And the formulas list between them approximately 100 plants. Some of those plants we can't identify, we don't know what they are. But in that list, there are many plants which are either plants containing monoamine oxidase inhibitors or plants containing DMT. So this, again, is an indication that they were up to complex plant formula concoctions in those days. So that was a very interesting piece of information. The authors speculate that also that was the basis of Soma in ancient India. So I think you can even go further and say that it was almost certainly what they were up to. So that was the second bit of information which I found quite exciting. If we look in the Vedas also, there are quite a number of plants which are also not identified. Identified, or the significance has not been explained. One of the plants is Kushta. Now, if we look in the Atharva Veda in particular, there are quite a few references to Kushta. Now, Kushta has botanical identifications in this whole process was an absolute nightmare. All these, so many botanical identifications. You've got one Sanskrit word, and goodness knows what it's referring to. You know, there's local identifications. The botanical identifications change every 20 or 30 years. You know, so it's very, very tricky to work out what plant's being referred to. But Kushta has got two botanical identifications, one as snow lotus and the other as ginger. Now, Kushta in the Vedas is praised in the same way as Soma. They say they praise Soma as the greatest thing, but they also say that Kushta is the greatest thing alongside it. Now, if it's snow lotus, I don't know where we're going, but if it's ginger, then if we take the possibility that it's not just ordinary ginger, but aromatic ginger. Now, aromatic ginger also grows in India. It grows widely in the Far East. It's used in Chinese cooking. Galangal, it's called. You can buy it in the Chinese supermarket. That is absolutely chock full of monoamine oxidase inhibitors, higher than even prescription medicine. So, again, if we're starting looking at the praise of these plants in the texts, various bits of the jigsaw puzzle start falling into place. So they're worshipping this plant because, of course, it's one of those plants that can be used in a concoction, and very effectively too. One of the plants I haven't been able to nail down is Silachi. That's another of those plants praised in the Vedas in the highest terms. No idea what that is. A plant I spent a lot of time looking at, which got unfortunately not very far with, was kush grass or darbha grass. Now, darbha grass, as you might know from Vedic studies, is everywhere. You know, the Brahmins are absolutely mad on kush grass or darbha grass. You know, it's in every ritual. It's all over the place. You know, it's for seats, for the deities, it's just everywhere. Now, why are they so mad on kusha grass? You know, it's just everywhere. Now, kusha grass is a relative of phalaris grass. And that's what set me off on this whole thing, actually, about 15 years ago. Because phalaris grass, it was only in the 1990s that phalaris grass, which is very, very common, it grows absolutely everywhere in the world. Many varieties of that are full of DMT. You can make, as the articles about, you can make ayahuasca from your lawn clippings, and it's true, if you know what you're doing. So then, the foremost expert on that is Giorgio Samorini, Italian researcher. He's published a lot of stuff, very, very good stuff, on phalaris grass. He's performed a lot of chemical analyses of phalaris grass, and some are very high DMT content, some no DMT. Different seasons, different places, different varieties. You get enormous range of readings on the tests of kush grass, as I say, from none to loads. And he's published all this in tables, you know, to different varieties from different places. But when I realized that kush grass is a relative of phalaris grass, I thought this explains it. So 15 years ago, I had my first go at getting kush grass analyzed in a laboratory. I brought a sample back from India. And that went to Peter Houghton, who was then Professor of Pharmacology at King's. And anyway, nothing happened there. It went on and on and on and on. And it was extremely difficult to get tests done. I didn't realize how difficult it would be tests done on plants to find out what's in there. It's all right if you're from a scientific department with a scientific protocol. But if you're coming from the outside, if you want a private test done in Britain, it costs about £6,000 per test. And you need at least several tests to even get anywhere. So that was out, being a poor Brahmin. So the alternative was to find a friendly university that would do it for me. Well, I've been all around the houses on this one. Laboratories in Vienna and Madrid and Bangalore and New York and Carolina, all over the place. Three in London. And everybody I talked to was extremely interested and very enthusiastic about the idea, but they said, actually, we can't really run this because it doesn't fit in it. You know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not in a scientific department. There's no protocol. It's just a hunch, all this stuff. Finally, Simon Gibbons, very kindly at London School of Pharmacy, this is after some years, I got a test done on some cush grass. Just this year we got the results. There was no DMT. But that was one sample who knows? So I just don't. This is a speculative thing about the cush grass. But the other thing is that if we look at the substitutes, I spent some time looking at what in the Brahman is the substitute or alternative plants then, and many of those substitute plants or alternative plants are kinds of grass. So I'm thinking that most probably they were getting the DMT out of varieties of grass. That is the hypothesis. But even without that being the case, there are enough other plants mentioned in the text, in the Brahmanas and in the Sanghita parts of the Veda to give clues for any future research on this subject, should anybody be interested in this whole topic. So just to conclude, the final thing is was looking at the Greek mystery rites, as I mentioned. I believe it was the basis of the Greek mystery rites. The only serious proposition for what was the basis of the Greek mystery rites, there are some very good scholars, including the best scholars in the world on Greek mystery rites, Burkert, for example, who believes that no drug was involved at all, that it was religious frenzy. But we're talking about when we're talking about what happened to people at Eleusis, they describe the most beatific vision, they describe all these things that happened. And they drink the kokaon, the mixed potion, again, bitter brownish, reddish liquid in a short 200 milliliter shot. So it seems to me that to just put it down to just purely religious inspiration is stretching it. If it was the case that they were drinking a psychedelic concoction in ancient Greece and southern part of Rome in the Greco-Roman Empire, what were they using? All scholars agree that the other mystery cults in the ancient Greco-Roman world, and before they were prohibited in the 4th century, were all based on the rites of Eleusis. So what they were doing in Eleusis gives us light onto what they were doing elsewhere in the ancient Greco-Roman world. There have only been, similarly with the Soma hypothesis, there are people who've argued that it's mushrooms. Again, if we look at the mushroom hypothesis, in order to initiate up to 3,000 people at a time at Eleusis during their annual rites, we're talking about collecting a gigantic number of mushrooms, 3,000 times 30 or something. There's no record anywhere in Greek literature about the collecting, large-scale collecting of mushrooms. And the hypothesis which has attracted most attention is the hypothesis presented in 1978 by Albert Hofmann, Carl Ruck and Gordon Wasson, The Road to Eleusis, where they suggest it was the ergot fungus. So I looked at that in some detail. The ergot hypothesis assumes that they had a way of cleaning ergot sufficiently to extract lysergic acid amide. Now, there are several kinds of ergot fungus. The one proposed by Albert Hofmann, the famous discoverer of LSD, his proposition was for a kind of ergot that, in fact, other researchers have pointed out subsequently, was not possible because it only grows on a type of grass that was introduced into Europe only 100 years ago. So they couldn't have been using that. They must have been using a more toxic variety of ergot. Now, ergot, famously, is a vasoconstrictor, gangrene, etc. So you've really got to clean that thing up completely. Of course, in the production of LSD, they usually start with the ergot fungus, but there, of course, it's an advanced high-tech process to extract lysergic acid amide out of the ergot fungus, then change it into diethyl amide and so on to produce LSD. Now, these days, that's done with advanced laboratory equipment and chemicals. Now, even if they had the technique to extract the toxic chemicals out of the ergot fungus, they'd be left with lysergic acid amide. Now, that on its own, that occurs also in Hawaiian baby wood rose. It also occurs in morning glory seeds of certain kinds. Lysergic acid amide on its own is also not that visionary. It gives a kind of lassitude. It's certainly psychedelic, but it's a kind of spacey kind of experience, not the kind of experience you get on DMT, which is very powerfully psychedelic. It's also very unsettling for the stomach and so on. But I think the main problem with the ergot fungus is how, in the ancient world, they were able to actually extract or get out, clean the ergot fungus sufficiently so that it wasn't deadly or completely toxic. Mm-hmm. There have been theories proposed by a couple of American chemists about how they might do that, using potassium and using wood ash to get the potassium out and various other procedures, but it strikes me as extremely improbable. And the other thing is that if it had been gone slightly wrong, a lot of people would have died. So that's the only other hypothesis, apart from mushrooms, about what they were using in the ancient Greek world. But if we consider the cocaine as literally mixed potion, then it all starts making sense that that's probably what they were doing in ancient Greece as well. So I'm going to stop there.